All rise. The Chief Judge and the judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please take your seats. The court will come to order. Good morning. I understand, defense counsel, you would like 5 minutes to reserve, fellow counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are counsel for both sides ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're here to hear the case of United States versus Amber First Class Amy Shook. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You may proceed.
Chief Judge Orr, members of the court, may it please the court. On 14 July 2011, this court set aside the action of the convening authority, voided the RCM 1109 hearing, and remanded the case for new action by the convening authority. 33 days later, the record was forwarded to the convening authority, and Airman Shook remained in confinement. 10 days after that, the convening authority took action in the case consistent with the pretrial agreement and approved a sentence to confinement of only 18 months. And again, Airman Shook remained in confinement. Finally, 3 days later, on 29 August 2011, Airman Shook was finally released from confinement. In a case where Airman Shook's pretrial agreement limited confinement to 18 months, Airman Shook served 22 months and 16 days in jail. I would like to address three issues with the court today, kind of working in reverse order. First, the appropriate relief for assignment of error, two, standing alone. Second, appellant's continued confinement beyond 30 days from the date of this court's 14 July opinion. And three, the date appellant was actually entitled to release from confinement. Now, the first point is talking about relief for assignment of error two, standing alone, independent of assignment of error one. And in this case, this court should disapprove the fine of $1,100 for the fact that appellant Airman Shook spent 46 days in confinement after this court issued its opinion. Again, those 46 days should be considered in tandem with assignment of error one for the relief request in assignment of error one. Now, turning to the second main point, the illegal confinement after 30 days from the date of this court's opinion. At a minimum, Airman Shook should have been released from confinement on 15 August 2011, which was actual day 32 after this court issued its opinion on 14 July. Now, simply calculating, that's 15 days, obviously, inclusive of 15 August to 29 August, the actual day she was released. If you calculate 100 days of being equivalent to 1 day in confinement, that alone justifies setting aside the fine of $1,100. This same issue was raised in the habeas petition before this court, which was withdrawn once Airman Shook was released. It was also raised before the convening authority again when the case went back before the convening authority. The reason why Airman Shook, at the very least, should have been released on 15 August 2011 is because of United States v. Miller, which controls this case. Now, United States v. Miller talks about when does an appellant get the benefit of a favorable decision by a court of criminal appeals, and created a rule in which an appellant is entitled to activation, if you will, of that favorable decision at the earlier of either the judge advocate general, the government, declining to pursue further action in the case, or 30 days. 30 days being the dates upon which the Courts of Criminal Appeals rules allow for reconsideration, and the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces allows for certification by the judge advocate general of any issues. Now, we know that day 30 was 13 August 2011, which was a Saturday. So we would submit that she should have been entitled to release on 13 August, but to be fair, we'll stick with business days and the first day after day 30 being 15 August, the Monday, that she should have, at the very least, been entitled to release at that point. But what should have happened, as the Court of Criminal Appeals, the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces and Miller states, is even though the opinion is could remain inchoate at that point, still entitled to the benefit. Doesn't provide explicit guidance on what should occur in that case, but what should happen is the judge advocate general, through his agent for this process, should have directed the convening authority to release Airman Shook. And that would be consistent with Article 66E. In this case, the agent for the Judge Advocate General did eventually forward the record of trial on day 33, which was 16 August 2011, and did not provide any special instructions whatsoever to the convening authority to direct Airman Shook's release from confinement consistent with United States v. Miller. Not only that, is that an error and in violation of United States v. Miller, but it's in violation of AFI 51201, paragraph 11.12, which states that any special instructions deemed necessary to carry out the mandate of the court will be transmitted by Apoloa JAJM with the remanded rod. And we did submit a motion to attach, which this court granted, from Ms. Hattie Simmons, the agent for this process, talking about how this process works. So at the very least, Airman Shook should have been released from confinement at 15 August 2011, because at the very least, under Miller, that would have been the day 30 and the day in which she was entitled to the activation of this court's favorable decision. Now, the third issue to discuss...
But looking at the decision of this court, how do you determine that from that decision, from the original decision in Shook, how do you determine that that was an order to release her?
Your Honor, because this court's opinion by operation of law restored the status quo ante. This court, when it set aside the action, because it avoided the improper RCM 1109 hearing, which attempted to improperly vacate the convening authority's obligations under the pretrial agreement, this court reactivated the pretrial agreement for 18 months. And she had physically served, in excess of 18 months at that point.
But let me ask you this. If the convening authority had then decided, okay, we'll go with the full 3 years, then where are we?
Well,
we'll follow your argument.
Understand, Your Honor. What should have happened is the convening authority should have released Airman Shook immediately. And if the convening authority decided that they did want to conduct a new RCM 1109 hearing, then they could have done that. And at the completion of a properly conducted RCM 1109 hearing, then they could have remanded Airman Shook back into post-trial confinement. But at the time this court set aside the action and set aside the improper 1109 hearing, she had already served 18 months of confinement, and she was entitled to the benefit of that bargain, of that binding contract with the convening authority, until he properly abrogated his obligations under that contract, under the rules prescribed in RCM 1109.
1109 gives the convening authority 7 days to conduct the hearing if it were a normal suspension hearing, and it looks like the opinion gives the convening authority that option to proceed under 1109, and if we kind of extend the procedure a little bit. I know the decision didn't say this, but when it gets back down there, the NRA says, okay, to proceed under 1109, let's look at 1109, and one of those provisions says, well, I can confine this person if I think they've violated the terms of the suspension, but I need to do a hearing within 7 days. That doesn't sound like they have to release them. It sounds like they need to do a hearing within 7 days or release them.
Understand, Your Honor, and that's a different scenario. And again, what the 1109 is the vacation of a suspended punishment or a suspended sentence, whereas we're talking about the convening authority abrogating his responsibilities, his obligations under the pretrial agreement, and the guidelines says you should follow the guidelines in RCM 1109 when conducting the hearing. So that's a scenario where there's the person presumably is in confinement, and the committee authority, for whatever reason, is deciding I'm going to vacate the suspension and let them and notify them. Now, Miller also answers this question as well by saying that you either release the appellant or you conduct an RCM 305 pretrial confinement review hearing if the convening authority believes continued confinement is necessary. However, that could not be the case here to do an RCM 305 hearing because she had already served 18 months of confinement. So it's in the best way to explain this is by analogy. If you have which is a scenario that occurs not infrequently, say a shorter capped confinement pretrial agreement, let's just say 30 days, but the community authority doesn't take action until 45 days after the sentence is imposed, the accused in that case does not remain in confinement for 45 days. They're released at day 30. That's why it says PTA cap on the Air Force Form 1359, report of the result of trial, and it also says it on the confinement order. And we know from the evidence that was attached to the record that that's exactly what happened in appellant's case. It was reset.
In that scenario, the judge sentences the cap, right?
Could you repeat that, Your Honor?
In your scenario, the judge sentence becomes the cap, not the PTA.
No, Your Honor. The until a properly conducted RCM 1109 hearing takes place, the cap is the 18 months because appellant Aaron Shook is entitled to the benefit of the bargain until such time as the community authority properly voids the contract through a hearing modeled on the RCM 1109 process. So that's why she was entitled to release at the very least on 15 August 2011. And what I'd like to turn.
Well, tell me something. Why isn't the RCM 1109 process for vacating a suspension somewhat analogous to this? Because in essence, she's in jail. And you're saying, well, she should be released, but then under 1109, the convening authority can put them in jail while they decide if they can't get the 1109 process completed in time. They can hold them for 7 days. So why isn't that this situation analogous, at least for a seven-day period?
Your Honor, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you on that it's not analogous, but there's no evidence in the record that the convening authority ever took any manifest step towards considering an RCM 1109 hearing. Well, by...
So wasn't that what he was doing from the time the JJM remanded to the convening authority?
We have no evidence of that, and actually we have evidence of the contrary.
Well, the evidence would be that the court's decision was given to him, and we would presume, shouldn't we, that he was following the orders of this court?
And then they gave the defense an opportunity to submit something.
Yes, Your Honor. I did represent Airman Shook in the post-trial submissions, and we did submit the fact that in the clemency letter that the staff judge advocate for the convening authority indicated they were not going to do any sort of 1109 hearing and just approve the PTA. So that's in the record. So we know that it wasn't the fact that during this period in which it had been remanded that the convening authority was actually contemplating whether or not to do an RCM 1109 vacation hearing or hearing modeled on that RCM 1109. We know that's not the fact. We know that he wasn't contemplating that at all. So,
unless how do you know that?
Well, Your Honor, I submitted that in post-trial, the conversation with the staff judge advocate of the convening authority, that they had no intention of conducting the RCM 1109 hearing.
Well, the record would tend to show that at least until the SJR, where the SJA recommends that they not conduct it, that would seem to be the evidence in the record that at least at that point the SJA was recommending against it. So there was obviously a consideration going on, wasn't there?
I disagree, Your Honor. I disagree with that. I mean, again, we also filed a habeas petition on the very issue that upon it being remanded, upon the Miller maximum 30-day rule passing, there was no response to that either, that her continued confinement was illegal. No response whatsoever from the government on that. So there is no evidence before this court that the convening authority was contemplating an RCM 1109 hearing and just simply at the end of whatever amount of time decided not to. And I would also argue, Your Honor, that both Senior Judge Gregory and Judge Weiss mentioned the 7 days for an RCM 1109 hearing. This was remanded back to the community authority on 16 August 2011 with instructions to take action by 24 August 2011. And the community authority did not take action until 26 August 2011. Again, there was nothing in there to indicate that at any point the community authority...
Well, I think the order said 24 August, didn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. It said 24.
Okay.
Well, I may be wrong on that. I thought it said 26 August, but I could be wrong on that. That's when we received it, but...
I think 24 August, I think, is the date, but...
Your Honor, are you referring to the remand or the actual community authority action?
The convening authority.
What's
the
that?
Remand to the convening.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I said. 24 August, he was directed to complete action by 24 August, but did not actually complete action until 26 August. Turning to the third main point I'd like to address today with the court is that appellant should be entitled to the full 46 days of illegal confinement. She should be entitled to illegal confinement credit for the entire 46-day period that elapsed after 14 July 2011, the date this court issued its opinion. And the reason why is because, again, Miller controls this case, and the Miller triggering event for when Airman Shook's interest in this court's favorable decisions activated is the earlier of 30 days or the government's decision not to pursue further action.
Counsel, even if I agree with that, where's the evidence in the record that says TJAG or made a decision before that point, before the 30 days? It would appear from the record that the 30 days elapsed and then by default our decision was forwarded to the convening authority at that point. Where's the evidence that a decision was made prior to that?
Your Honor, there is no evidence. There is no evidence that occurred. But for that reason, the inference is warranted that that's not what occurred. The inference is warranted that the decision was made by the government the date this court issued its opinion not to take further action. And I would cite to the Gonzalez case from the First Circuit that I cited in our reply, which says, quote, it is elementary that if a party has evidence in its control and fails to produce it, an inference may be warranted that the document would have been unfavorable. That inference is warranted here because appellant sought through post-trial discovery to obtain this information, and the government has declined to provide the information as to when they declined to take further action in this case. And that's fine. The government can stand on principle and say, we're not going to give you that information. We don't want to disclose that. That's fine. However, if they so choose to do that, they must also accept the inference that they decided to not pursue further action the day this court issued its opinion, because they cannot be allowed to hold the evidence that would potentially entitle Airman Shook to an earlier release than the 30-day default, and then say, we're not going to give you this information, but you lose on this issue because you haven't proved when we made a decision.
So I understand you, you're saying the very date of this court's opinion is automatically the day the TJAG decided not to reconsider or certify.
If absent evidence from the government to the contrary, that is the inference warranted in this case. Yes, Your Honor. So that's important in the inference rule that the Gonzalez case in the First Circuit talks about should be applied in this military setting by virtue of the fact that this court, its opinions are not self-executing. So the way for this court to have the government abide by its decisions to carry out its mandates is to ensure that the government does their job and determines if there's going to be a further course of action, and if not, to timely forward the record back to the community authority for new action or whatever consistent with this court's opinion. It's imperative that this court adopt this rule for this particular scenario in order to ensure that this court's mandates are carried out effectively and in a timely manner by the government.
So is 30 days inconsistent then?
Your Honor?
Is the 30-day that the letter was in there, is that inconsistent with our rule?
I'm sorry, the letter, Your Honor?
Yeah, from Harry Simmons. Is that inconsistent with the ruling that we made?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's inconsistent because, again, the Miller rule is the earlier of the government declining to pursue further action or the 30-day period for further review has passed. So it's the earlier of. And in this case, we know that the agent for the government for sending the record back holds the case for 30 days to allow for the consideration of further review, but that doesn't tell us when, if any, that further review is considered. And that's why the inference is appropriate in this case, that the government...
So just so I'm clear, it's either 30, if no decisions are made, or zero.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes. Again, and this is an automatic rule. It's just for this particular case. And to illustrate this point, this court should look to the motion to submit documents that the government just recently submitted, in which they talk about the United States versus Jones case, in which this court reassessed the sentence of the appellant, Jones, to a point in which Jones was entitled to immediate release from confinement. In that case, the government notified the applicable personnel, the brig, counsel for Jones, that we are not going to pursue further action in this case. And that occurred on the second business day after the court issued its opinion. And so in that case, it went back released. And so for reasons unknown, the government is willing to provide this court with information as to what happened in subsequent cases, but refuses to provide this court with the information as to when a decision was made in this case. And that's why the inference is appropriate that a decision was made not to pursue further action on the date this opinion was issued, which is 14 July. Now, unless there's any further questions from the court, I'll just reserve the balance of my time. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Linnell Latendra, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States. The appellant in this case has no prayer for relief when the government has met its deadlines in returning the record of trial back to the convening authority, and when the convening authority took action in a very reasonable amount of time. The government will first turn to the first allegation that appellant has raised here at oral argument, that somehow 10 days is unreasonable and that his client should have been released the exact day that it was returned, that this case was returned to the convening authority. Case law simply does not support such a position. Instead, United States versus Miller talks about the idea that once a 30-day clock has expired, that one of two things is to happen. Either release or an RCM 305K hearing is to be held. But the Miller court did not state that RCM 305 hearing should be made the very day that a record of trial is returned back to a convening authority, nor did they give some sort of timeline for when release is to occur. So the government would propose that this court look at this through the lens of reasonableness. Did the government actions that followed the return of the record of trial portray reasonableness? And we could look at what first did the JJM set as when a new action should be returned. As Judge Weiss indicated correctly, that the JJM indicated that the record should be, a new action should be made by the 24th of August. So this court should look very carefully at what occurred between the 16th of August and the 24th of August. And when you look there, as opposed to appellant's allegations that there was some sort of foot dragging on the government, it is quite clear that instead, the record is returned on the 16th. By the 19th, there is a staff judge advocate recommendation, an SJAR, that is forwarded to the convening authority, forwarded to defense counsel and the appellant in this case. They managed to get appellant in confinement. She receives it and receipts for it. There is evidence in the record that also was sent to defense counsel on the 19th of August. He receipted for that on the 23rd of August. After that, on the 24th, the defense provided clemency to include a response from defense counsel, as well as an unsigned appellant letter from the appellant. And there was discussions or emails, as was submitted by the appellant, between the convening authority's legal advisor and the appellant about, hey, here's actually an extra signed letter, but that came after the convening authority had even taken action. So what we see is a convening authority who's moving out very, very quickly in this case.
All right. Now, assuming the convening authority did act reasonably, how do you explain the time period between the 26th of August, when the action was taken, and the day she was released from confinement?
The record indicates that sometime on the 26th, there's a date stamp but not a time stamp, that the convening authority signed stating that he had reviewed the clemency submission and he signed the new action. So whether or not that took place in the morning or late at night, this record simply doesn't indicate. That occurred on a Friday, and she was released on the following Monday. The record is silent as to what happened on the Saturday and Sunday. But even considering a delay of a Saturday and Sunday in between, this court should not find that time period is in any way an unreasonable one warranting remedy.
Counsel,
by this court.
Don't you think the appellant's liberty interests become paramount as soon as the convening authority signed that action, that every effort should have been made to release her, that a weekend is inconvenient, that they shouldn't have released her at that point? Won't the government at least concede that those 3 days were probably improper?
Well, the record is silent as to whether or not they drugged their foot, as to whether or not what took place between the 26th and the 29th. And in looking at cases that the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces has looked to, additional post-trial confinement and whether or not that period of confinement warrants some additional relief, the Court of Appeals looked at the case in Rosendahl, and they found that 120 days was not a period of confinement in which credit was warranted. In fact, they called that 120 days a relatively short period of time. And therefore, when we look at this in relationship to Kaff's decision in Rosendahl, then no, the government would not concede that 2 additional days that the accused or the appellant warrants any type of relief, because the government followed in reasonable footsteps or took reasonable action to act upon this court's holding and ruling. And I would also like to clarify that the appellant has cited via a motion to supplement the record to AFI 51201, specifically paragraph 11.2. And in that paragraph, it's important to note what that paragraph states and doesn't state. What it says is when JJM deems it necessary to provide additional instructions, then they should do that in returning a record of trial to the convening authority. There was no additional instructions necessary because this court's ruling was quite clear. And this court's ruling did not, in contrary to what the appellant states, return this to the, quote, status quo ante. In fact, what this court stated in very clear terms was that the record of trial was returned and to the convening authority, or that TJAG should make that return happen. And this is what you asked the convening authority to do, to determine whether further proceedings under RCM 1109 are practicable, and then, if deemed impractical, the convening authority shall enter a new action. This language by the court was quite clear, and this idea that 51201, 11.2 requires any additional instructions by JJM when this court's language is quite clear should not be given any weight. And because the government took reasonable actions upon the return of the record of trial to the convening authority, this court should reject any sort of relief to the appellant.
How do you address the appellant's argument that our decision reactivated the PTA, and because she had already served a period of confinement in excess of 18 months, that somehow she should be entitled to release at that point after the 30 days?
Well, the government would answer with just the discussion that we had concerning the actual language of this court. This court did not, and an appellant even admits as much in a footnote in his, both in his assignment of error and his reply, that this court did not use language of we reinstitute the pretrial agreement. Instead, this court gave direction to the convening authority to do one of two things. First, to determine whether or not an RCM 1109 hearing was practicable, and if he wanted to do that. If he had chosen to do that, then quite frankly, the appellant would have been in jail a lot longer than 11 days, because he would have then instituted the 1109 hearing to have taken place. But instead, the convening authority chose the other alternative given by this court. But it was an alternative choice given to the convening authority. This court did not implement or go back to or resurrect a pretrial agreement as of the date that it was returned to the convening authority. Instead, this court specifically directed the convening authority to make a decision between those two options.
You mentioned the reasonableness as far as evaluating the conduct of the convening authority. What's your view? I ask that. What's your view on using 1109's 7 days in which to have a hearing that locks somebody up and vacate the suspension, since we actually reference that in the opinion procedures under 1109 rule? Why isn't 7 days a good template to use?
I think that is a reasonable template, as well as a reasonable template given by JJM when returning the case. They returned it on the 16th of August and said to have a new action by the 24th of August. But you then have to look at not just did the total days then go beyond that 7 day, but also look within and internally and what was happening. And what was happening is that the government provided a staff judge advocate recommendation recommending the latter, that there not be an 1109 hearing, and gave that to the defense on the 19th of August. And the defense receded for that, and it is unclear why the defense receded for that on the 23rd when it's clear that the government provided it on the 19th per the documents in the record. And so there is some sort of disconnect between the 19th and the 23rd. There is a weekend, but it was clearly provided to the defense in advance of that weekend. And then the defense chose to submit something on the 24th and asked that the convening authority move out and waive the remainder of their time. So clearly the defense was moving forward after that point. But to consider that just because this is beyond a 7 day period is not the full extent of the inquiry that this court should conduct. Moving then to the...
What if the convening authority would have waited a month before doing something? Is that unreasonable?
I think it depends on the facts and the circumstances of the case at hand. I think the other issue to look at in your hypothetical would be, did the convening authority also hold some sort of 305 hearing as called for by Miller, almost in conjunction with this idea of an 1109 hearing? Did she need to remain in that confinement status until the 1109 hearing was held? So I think there would be a variety of factors, but that is not this case. And this case shows that the government acted with reasonableness after the return of the record of trial. Furthermore, it is quite clear, moving to the other issue raised by appellant, that the government met its deadline in returning the convening returning the record of trial back to the convening authority. As this court well knows, it is well established by decisions of our superior court that both CCA and CAF decisions are not self-executing. They are inchoate, and they don't take effect until one of a couple of things happens. First, a 30-day time period passes in which both parties, appellant, the government, and this court, can ask or grant reconsideration. In fact, your rule number 19 specifically says that this court can sua sponte grant a reconsideration, not even having the parties move for that. This is that 30-day time period in which the appellant gets to take a look at the case, the government gets to take a look at the case, and make some decisions, not only regarding reconsideration, but about regarding petitions for cert on the basis of the appellant, petitions under Article 67 on the basis of the appellant, they get 60 days to do that, or in the government's hands, that we get 30 days to request and filter through the Judge Advocate General to request certification.
Well, what should we do with the proposition that unless you provide us with a specific date, the date is zero?
This court should reject that notion wholesale. There is absolutely no case law support for such a proposition. And in fact, the case law supports just the opposite. In both United States versus Miller and as recently reaffirmed by the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces and United States versus Kreutzer in February of this case, there is no such thing as a decide immediately government. And in absence of some sort of governmental showing that this court should presume or make some sort of inference against the government. In fact, Miller and the language of Miller and Kreutzer shows just the opposite. What is very telling from our Superior Court is that both the majority and the dissent agree upon this point. They state, for example, in the majority decision, that the appellate does have an interest, certainly has an interest in a favorable decision by the CCA. However, the court went on to explain that that interest does not become sufficiently weighty to warrant action until one of a couple things happen. Either the Judge Advocate General makes a decision to either seek recon or to certify a case, or the 30 days elapses. The dissent even agrees with this proposition when it says that once TJAG certifies, or the 30-day period for certification ends, the appellant's interest in a favorable decision below takes effect. There is no such determination or avenue for this court to somehow pierce through this 30-day time period and try to determine whether or not or when a decision was made, because the courts have given this period. In fact, the United States versus Miller went so far as to say that Congress established this notion that the Judge Advocate General could seek cert. And in Miller, it stated that in looking at this, that the court, in looking at this, finds that this is a reasonable time period. And so this, the 30-day time period is per se reasonable. And that this court should reject any notion that the government has some sort of affirmative duty to prove up when or whether when a decision was made.
But TJAC did make a decision on day 15 not to pursue a reconsideration or certification. What should have happened at that point?
Well, we have evidence through when the government provided examples of what a decision looks like. And it's important for this court to recognize what how the government enunciates or shows a decision. We have no decision here because there is no documentation in the record. And let me give you some examples of what a decision looks like. First, if the government had decided to request reconsideration, this court, as evidenced in United States versus Anderson, would receive a motion from the government stating, we request reconsideration and the reasons why. We provided a sample of what that looks like in our motion to submit documents. In addition, if the government makes a decision to not go forward, you will see something similar to what the United States did in United States versus Jones. An email going to all parties, hereby certifying that in recognition that we have 30 days for reconsideration or certification, the government is hereby choosing not to go forward. That goes to all parties and to JAJM, so that it is very clear that a government decision has been made. Otherwise, the decision, as was the decision that was made in this case, is evidenced by the return of the rot. That is a government document. JAJM and the appellate records decision specifically returning a record of trial to the convening authority. And that represents a government document indicating a governmental decision. And why is it important that we look towards those types of documents, unlike the type that appellant requested and which this court denied in his attempts to obtain post-trial discovery. It's important to look at those types of official documents because it represents when and how a governmental body makes a decision. For example, we could have a government agent who, or someone over in JHAG, let's say the captain who had this case, who wakes up and goes, I want to take this for reconsideration. And the next layer up could go, no, we're not. And then the next time they could have some discussion with the numbered Air Force and they could point out something different, and the intermediary level might be convinced to change their mind. None of those are governmental decisions. That's the government working through the decision process, all of which is covered under work product, and communications with the NAF covered under attorney-client type of coverage. And therefore, this court should only be looking for evidence of a governmental decision that has gone to all parties as the examples that the government provided. I would like to turn specifically in this vein to appellant's articulation that this court should somehow draw an inference that the government somehow has some affirmative duty, affirmative burden here, which goes against RCM 905 and the whole premise that normally it is the moving party that has the burden of persuasion on any factual issue. But in addition to that, this court should not be swayed whatsoever by the First Circuit decision cited by appellant in Gonzalez. That case was an insurance contract case, a civil litigation issue dealing with a piece of evidence, an attachment, if you will, to the contract itself, and about whether or not the claim regarding an aircraft accident hinged upon some information in this particular document. In a trial setting, is when a civil one at that, is when this court made, when that court, excuse me, made a, had this discussion about some sort of negative inference being held against a party. Essentially what appellant is asking this court to do is to first allow appellant to not put forth any shred of evidence of any sort of government misconduct, and instead shift the entire burden over to the government without even some sort of prima facie showing that something went awry, and then allow the appellant to have some sort of unfettered fishing expedition into governmental decision-making processes. That is not warranted, especially when this court denied post-trial appellate discovery. In other words, they want you to draw a negative inference for something that you yourselves have said is not warranted in this case. And this court should deny drawing any sort of negative inference and fall back to what Miller and Kreutzer have done by saying that the Judge Advocate General is entitled to 30 days to decide, and that when the government meets its deadline, that is per se reasonable and there is no prejudice or impact or remedy that this appellant is entitled to. If this court, assuming arguendo, were to attempt to look further at the at what went into the 30 days and hold somehow that the government is somehow responsible for proving up, it would also contradict what this court and our Superior Court has looked at in, for example, the Moreno issue. This is actually where Simon Rivera 1 and 2, there's some similarities here. Because essentially what this, what the appellant is asking is that we, even though we meet a deadline, or as in Simon Rivera 1, even when this court meets the Moreno deadline of issuing a decision in 18 months, that this court should somehow probe behind the reason behind that met deadline and explore the inner workings of what occurred either in that 18 months or in this 30 days. And that simply doesn't make sense. And this court should deny that this that is what Miller or Kreutzer requires.
Counsel, if we would find 46 days of improper confinement or something less than that, what would be an appropriate remedy?
Well, first, the government would point out that it appears that the appellant has conceded or withdrawn their initial request, both in their assignment of errors as well as their reply, for this court to do away with the bad conduct discharge with respect to assignment of error 2. That is specifically the remedy that was requested and in writing to this court. But it appears through oral argument that they have pulled back on that and are now just asking for a reduction in the fine. To the extent that they are holding firm to their bad conduct discharge, this court should look at both Rosendahl and Josie, both Court of Appeals decisions dealing with post-trial confinement, where later, either through a rehearing or a resentencing, the confinement credit was done away with, or the confinement was done away with, and in essence, we had an extra amount of time. Specifically, I would encourage this court to look at Rosendahl, where, as previously noted, the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces found that 120 days was not sufficient to receive any sort of credit against a bad conduct or a punitive discharge. And it follows the same line of reasoning. In fact, this court cited to both of those cases in its recent decision in Zalbertani that punitive discharges are just fundamentally different. Punitive discharges are qualitatively different because it's related to a personnel decision. And as this court indicated in Zarbatani, when it found that the bad conduct discharged appropriately characterized the misconduct of that accused, who was AWOL twice for less than 3 days and used cocaine and marijuana on two different occasions, so should this court find that the Walmart of drugs, this appellant, an appellant who not only used drugs to include oxycodone, heroin, meth, methadone, Percocet, but also sold drugs to fellow airmen, used heroin in her dorm room using needles from the base hospital, and also encouraged and was giving tips to a fellow airman on how to become a drug dealer on base, that this court should find that the accused does not warrant any sort of remedy, especially with respect to her punitive discharge. And therefore, the government would articulate that the appellant has not been prejudiced. And because the appellant has not been prejudiced, this court should not look to any remedy and instead find that the appellant who is entitled to some amount of back pay, that serves as essentially the sole remedy in this case, because anything else would not be proper. And so in conclusion, the government would respectfully request that this court deny and reject appellant's request for a deadline before a deadline, that appellant is simply not entitled to relief when the government meets its deadline, and when the government behaves in a reasonable fashion after a record of trial has been returned. Thank you.
So before you sit down, I just want to make sure I understand your position. Clearly, the convening authority approved 18 months of confinement. She served more than that. So what do you suggest we do with that time?
Your Honor, nothing. And that would be consistent with the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces with respect to their decision in Rosendahl. Rosendahl found that 120 days was relatively short, and that that Rosendahl did not deserve any amount of additional credit. This appellant served 139 days. Your Honors, I point Your Honors to the government's brief in how to calculate that time period. 139 days and 120 days are substantially similar, and this appellant is not entitled to relief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor. 1 day of illegal confinement is unreasonable. The government won't concede that the 3 days between action and release was illegal. The government won't even concede that. Not only was there not instructions for the convening authority to release appellant pursuant to Miller, there wasn't even any instructions from the convening authority himself to release Airman Shook. Typically, in a case where an accused has served in excess of, has served the confinement and they have a punitive discharge, it says the time of confinement having been served, go on appellate leave under Article 76A. It doesn't even say that. It says the term of confinement will be served and then go on 76 alpha. So that even the convening authority didn't even bother to instruct that Airman Shook be released upon action. And I want to go back to a question that Judge Weiss and Senior Judge Gregory asked me and flesh that out a little bit more regarding the seven-day rule in RCM 1109. First, let's look at RCM 1109 and what it says under 1109C4, which is that alpha, rights of the accused, before the preliminary hearing, the accused shall be notified in writing of the time, place, and purpose of the hearing, including the alleged violations of the condition of suspension, the right to be present at the hearing. She was confined at Miramar. Presumably, a hearing would have been held at Travis, where the special court martial convening authority was located. The person required to personally hold the hearing. The opportunity, the right to be represented at counsel, the opportunity to be heard. The government wants to, says 7 days is reasonable, but doesn't seem to care about those aspects either. And there's no evidence in the record that any affirmative steps are being done to set it up, to give the accused appellant notice that this hearing was going to take place. And to answer the question more directly with Judge Weiss's following question, it was forwarded back on 16 August. 3 days later, the staff judge advocate recommended approving the pretrial agreement. And it seems that all that was left was to receive post-trial submissions from appellant and then take action. So the evidence is clear that there was never at any point a contemplation of an RCM 1109 hearing from the moment it was sent back to the convening authority. So those 7 days were not days in which the convening authority was contemplating an RCM 1109 hearing. Furthermore,
what would happen if he took this paragraph out of the staff judge advocate's recommendation and said, you know, I think I want to have a post-trial hearing? Could the convening authority have done that?
Yes, Your Honor. We're not disputing the fact that the convening authority could have conducted an RCM 1109
hearing. Recommendation to me.
What's that?
This SJA recommendation looks like it's a proposal to the convening authority saying that this is what I recommend, but it's still the convening authority's call.
That's correct, Your Honor. But again, once again, that's evidence that the opposite occurred, that he wasn't contemplating it. There's nothing in
it. This is evidence that the staff judge advocate wasn't contemplating.
True, but we have no evidence that the convening authority, all the evidence points to the opposite conclusion. It does not point that the convening authority was ever contemplating an 1109 hearing.
Yeah, but there's none either way.
I understand, Your Honor.
You've got a recommendation to a convening authority. What's this other evidence you're talking about?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You've got a recommendation saying, hey, boss, you can do A or B. I recommend B. You say, well, that means the convening authority never considered A. Where do you get that? I don't understand that.
I'm not saying he never considered it. It just appears that there's no evidence that he did. And I think that so the 7 days should not be interpreted as contemplating this when there's no evidence that that's what was done. And there is some evidence to the contrary.
The accused is currently in confinement in Naval Consolidated Brig Miramar, having served over 22 months of her sentence. Assuming we held the required hearing and approved the sentence again, I expect that she would be released on parole fairly soon.
Understand, Your Honor.
At some point, even if it's for us, you know, for a nanosecond, he's considering something because he's reading it, right?
Understand, Your Honor.
So how do you say he never considered it at all? I mean, I'm trying to understand your argument.
Basically. I'm not saying he never considered it. I'm just saying there's no evidence that he did. And to back it up even further to the 30, we still have these 30 days where it's just languishing and we have no evidence. And the government says that there's no documentation in the record, but yet they are the ones that hold this evidence. And they also state that, the government is entitled to 30 days to make this action. That is not true, and what they stated Kreutzer says is not what Kreutzer says. Kreutzer says that the appellant's interest in the decision becomes sufficiently weighty when either the 30 days runs or the government decides to take action, which could be either further review or abiding by the decision. It's the earlier of the two. There is no rule that, like what they were saying to Judge Weiss's question, that if they decide on day 15 that they get to wait until day 30. There's no rule. And moreover, we have no evidence that that's what happened. And to also
counsel, I think there wasn't the government saying in the documents they provided yesterday as some evidence of their process is that they would have notified the appellant had they made a decision on day 15 or 13 or 10. But there isn't any evidence of that process, or that they were going to seek certification or reconsideration, and that the end of the 30 days was their decision.
Your Honor, they can answer this question for the court by simply providing the evidence.
Doesn't your premise assume bad faith on the part of the government? Why should we think that?
It doesn't need to assume bad faith or not. It's very simple. Like, the government mistakes a decision with making a decision public when they said, you know, when we look here on day 2, we send an email out, on day 30, we move for reconsideration. That's when we made a decision. No, that's when the decision was made public. That doesn't tell this court when a decision was made. And the fact that the government is saying that a decision can be made prior to day 30 and simply not transmitted until day 30, it is not what the Miller rule says. It's the earlier of declining to take action or 30 days, because you cannot take action at that point because the 30 days is run under this court's rules and under CAF's rules. So the government can't say that we have 30 days to decide this and make our decision public, and ergo that's our decision. That's not what Miller says. And the problem here is, what the government talked about the Gonzalez case being a civil litigation case that hinged on a document in the other party's possession. Well, in this case, Airman Shook's liberty interest hinges on information in the possession of the government. The government action or decision not to pursue further action. And Article 66E clearly states that the Judge Advocate General shall, unless there's going to be further action by the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces, the Supreme Court, the President of Congress, shall send it back to the convening authority. There's no you shall wait 30 days. And the Miller rule says you get up to 30 days to make a decision. That's consistent with this court's rules, that's consistent with the Court of Appeals for Armed Forces rules. But if you don't make a decision by day 30, then the decision at that point, at the very latest, is activated. However, if you decide sooner, Miller specifically states the Judge Advocate General shall immediately send it back with directions to release the appellant. And so the question here...
Counsel, you made no showing that there was a decision made prior to the 30 days. There was not even an inkling of a showing, was there?
And that's where the inference comes in, Your Honor. This evidence is in the complete and exclusive custody and control of the government. We sought through a post-trial discovery request this information. The government refused to give it to us. Again, they are entitled to hold that information if they want on principle, so long as they understand that the inference is against them, and that the inference is that they decided on day zero. And if I may finish my answer to your question, Judge Weiss.
Yes.
Judge Orr, if I may. that they made a decision not to pursue further action on day 30. And if no further questions from the court, that concludes our presentation. Thank you, Chief Judge.
Thank you.
All right. I'd like to thank counsel for both sides for their argument. I'm sure my colleagues and I found them very helpful. And they're bringing no further business before the court today. We will render a decision in due course. The court is adjourned.
All right.